It is Monday, January 18th, Universal Time, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Micah Lippin in Washington. In the next half hour, I'll speak to one of our reporters here in Washington about why so many people around the United States were doing community service today. We'll bring you the highlights of the latest TV debate between the Democratic contenders for the U.S. presidency. An energy analyst speaks to us about the impact of Iranian oil coming back onto the market, and I'm gonna take you for a date, take you for a ride. We'll tell you what to expect in the U.S. country music scene in 2016. It's all ahead on International Edition. Well, every year on the third Monday in January, the United States celebrates the memory of slain civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. That day, known as MLK Day, is today, and it's a federal holiday on which federal government agencies are closed, except for VOA, of course. It's also a day in which people across the United States engage in community service. Earlier, VOA reporter Alberto Pimienta joined me in the studio to tell me why community service is such a prominent part of this holiday.
Well, what happened was is that in 1994, Congress pretty much designated the MLK holiday as a national day of service. So what we've seen all around the country is people just really going out there and helping their communities. But it started not too long ago in 1994, as I said, when Congress decided to take the decision to kind of commemorate the legacy of Dr. King by people going out there and helping and lending a hand to different communities all around the U.S.
Well, two of the most prominent people engaged in community service today are the president and first lady of the country. Can you tell us what they were doing today?
That's right. They got their hands dirty, Michael. They were out in a local school here in Washington, D.C., a local elementary school out in Anacostia, not too far away from a military base. So that means that a lot of these kids that got the opportunity to be around the first family this morning, this early afternoon, were from military families, and they planted vegetables, spinach. The president said he's a huge fan of spinach.
It's then a healthy food, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. Just like the first lady as well. This is just part of her big Let's Move campaign. You know, trying to be healthy, so helping the kids to start eating healthy from a very early age. And then they also joined by White House mentees and members of AmeriCorps. They were also preparing backpacks, if you will, with books and school supplies for these students. So not only every American or Americans all around the nation, but the first family themselves helping their local community here in Washington, D.C.
Right. So you've got the Obamas setting an example there. So what other kinds of community service events have you seen across the country today?
So you see different things, and not only today, because sometimes people do understand that it's a day off, even though that a lot of people wanted to want to call it a day on to help their communities. But a lot of things start happening during the weekend. So we've seen community cleanups in Texas. We've seen also parades, and in these parades, there are also school supplies being given away to students in need. We've seen that in Miami, Florida. We've also seen marches in New York City. We also got to say that it's been really, really cold this morning in the East Coast.
So freezing here, yeah.
Exactly. So all these students and parents really go out there on their day off and march in order to remember and commemorate the legacy of Dr. King. And then you also see things in Atlanta. These are just kind of memorial acts themselves trying to remember the unselfish and tireless mission of Dr. King here in the U.S. for the civil rights movement.
Right, and people really are going above and beyond when they brave the freezing conditions. Well, thank you very much to Alberto Pimienta for that report.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's turn now to our social media correspondent, Giabi Lee. She's here in the studio to give us some of the popular topics online about Dr. King. Hi, G.
Hi, Michael. Let's start with a trending hashtag. And you guessed it, it's hashtag MLK Day. There's actually an account by the same name set up back in 2008. It's the official account of the MLK Day of Service. So it's not surprising the account posted one of the most liked tweets today. It's a meme with Dr. King's quote that reads like this. Our lives begin to end the day we become silent about the things that matter.
Well, I've seen a lot of MLK quotes today on Twitter. Can you give us a few more that you've seen?
Sure. Another one reads like this. The time is always right to do what is right. And my personal favorite is, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere.
Well, what are the U.S. government's Twitter accounts saying about MLK Day? I would guess President Obama, as the first African-American president of the country, feels strongly about it.
Absolutely. This is what he tweeted from his @POTUS account. Today, we honor a man who challenged us to bend the arc of the moral universe toward justice. Let's keep working to realize Dr. King's dream. And of course, that's referring to his famous speech from 1963. During the speech, he said he has a dream that his children will one day live in a nation where they're not judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. And as we just heard from Alberto, President Obama and his wife Michelle began their scheduled Monday with volunteering at a DC elementary school. AmeriCorps shared a picture of the couple planting seeds and distributing books at the school this morning. It wrote, AmeriCorps members are proud to serve at Leckie Elementary School in D.C. with POTUS and FLOTUS on MLK Day, hashtag getting things done. The State Department at State DPT also tweeted about the MLK Day and urged people to check out mlkday.gov website to find out ways to get involved. Michael?
Well, thanks so much, G. That was G. Abby Lee. You can find her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. And she also tweets from our International Edition Twitter account, which is at VOA_IE. And you can find me there as well. I'm at Michael_Lippin. This is VOA.
Green Bee, for a healthier planet.
Residential homes are estimated to be responsible for about a third of the United Kingdom's greenhouse gas emissions. But researchers at Cardiff University hope to change that with what they consider to be a blueprint for a positive energy home, one that gives back more energy than it uses.
The innovation is combining the renewable energy supply, storage, and demand technologies together.
Joe Patterson is project leader on the Sulzer House at the Welch School of Architecture. She says most of the technologies are widely available to consumers. The home is built with high levels of insulation for low air leakage and solar panels on its roof. Here's Sulzer House architect Esther Coma.
The photovoltaic panels transform the radiation energy from the sun, and they convert this energy into electricity.
With a construction price of around $190,000, researchers also tried to make the three-bedroom house affordable and attractive to a typical home buyer. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
I'm Michael Lippin, and you're listening to VOA's International Edition. Well, the Democratic presidential candidates met for a fourth debate on Sunday night. They were engaging in verbal clashes, about U.S. domestic policy in an attempt to define their differences ahead of early primary voting that begins next month. VOA's Catherine Gibson has more.
Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders debated on what turned out to be a major day for President Barack Obama's foreign policy legacy. The candidates shared a cautious optimism on the exchange of prisoners and the completion of the Iran nuclear deal.
We've had one good day over 36 years, and I think we need more good days before we move more rapidly toward any kind of normalization.
Do I want to see that relationship become more positive in the future? Yes. Can I tell you that we should open an embassy in Tehran tomorrow? No, I don't think we should.
John Hudak of the Brookings Institution spoke to VOA via Skype about the impact on the presidential race.
Well, I think any day that the campaign talks about foreign policy is a good day for Secretary Clinton.
Clinton and Sanders are close in the polls in early voting states, but their differences came out sharply on domestic issues like gun control.
He has voted with the NRA, with the gun lobby, numerous times.
Sanders responded to the Clinton campaign's attacks on his health care proposals in recent days.
We're not going to tear up the Affordable Care Act. I helped write it.
And he attacked the Clinton campaign's ties to the financial industry.
I don't take money from big banks. I don't get personal speaking fees from Goldman Sachs.
The attack is a familiar one for Sanders, who has positioned his campaign as anti-establishment, while Clinton emphasized her experience and ties to President Obama.
I think as commander-in-chief, you've got to constantly be evaluating the decisions you have to make. I know a little bit about this, having spent many hours in the Situation Room advising President Obama.
We cannot keep talking past each other.
Former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley, who is running a distant third to Clinton and Sanders, urged a spirit of cooperation in a divisive election. Online, two moments gained attention. Secretary Clinton's pause as she considered her relationship with Russian President Vladimir Putin.
It's interesting. It's
And Senator Sanders' refusal to attack Secretary Clinton's husband, former President Bill Clinton, for his past indiscretions.
I'm going to debate Secretary Clinton, Governor O'Malley, on the issues facing the American people, not Bill Clinton's personal behavior.
This is the final debate for the Democratic Party before caucuses are held in Iowa on February 1st. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
The price of oil dropped to its lowest level since 2003 on Monday, just under $28 a barrel. Oil prices have been on the decline for months as investors anticipated a jump in supply from Iran, which had been awaiting a lifting of international sanctions on its oil industry. Well, that lifting of sanctions came on Saturday when the UN nuclear body confirmed that Iran has taken the necessary steps to curtail its nuclear activities under a deal with major world powers. Vandana Hari is an editorial director at energy information company Platts, which is based in London. My colleague Victor Beatty spoke to Hari on the phone and asked her whether Iran's readmission to the global oil market has raised concerns among investors about a growing glut in oil supplies.
Certainly since last year, and got progressively more amplified since the turn of the year as we stepped into January, when it started becoming clearer that Iran might get a sanctions waiver far easier and far sooner than expected. Now, there's a lot of debate still on when this additional 500,000 ramping up to 1 million barrels per day would actually flow into the markets. And aside from going by some of the statements coming out of Iran, we don't really have a very good idea of what the condition is like in when it comes to Iran's fields and related infrastructure. But what the markets seem to be doing for now is they have already been very fearful. There's been a panic in the markets we've seen since the start of this year, especially around the developments in China. And they are factoring in that fear and panic more. They seem to be factoring in the worst right now.
Well, you're saying fear and panic. Is the low price of oil, the price we haven't seen in more than a dozen years, a reflection of a slowing Asian economy?
When you talk about fundamentals, we've already talked about oversupplied markets. Even without Iran, we went through a 2015 where supply was easily anywhere between 1.5 to 2 million barrels per day more than demand. As you go into 2016, and some of this ties into the situation with China, attention has also turned toward the demand picture. Now, China is the second largest consumer of oil next to the U.S., and nearly for the past one decade has been the single biggest contributor to demand growth in a variety of industrial commodities and certainly in oil as well. So yes, that is a very real question right now on the minds of the market participants, that globally, with a lot of question marks on economic growth in China, in other emerging markets, which have traditionally been the centers of demand growth for oil, what can we expect? And again, they are factoring in much less demand growth or weaker demand growth, and certainly not a demand growth that will keep up with the supply growth this year.
And that was Vandana Hari of energy information company Platts speaking with International Edition's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. Russia's parliament has rejected a bill that would have allowed fines or jail time for public displays of affection or sexuality by anyone who is not heterosexual. As VOA's Daniel Scharf reports from Moscow, rights groups welcomed the rejection, but they're also calling for the repeal of a law against alleged gay propaganda.
The proposed law had sought to punish public expression by non-heterosexuals in Russia, but was rejected by a parliamentary committee. Activists welcomed the rare win for Russia's lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender community. But they say a 2013 law against the promotion of non-traditional sexual relations among minors, the so-called gay propaganda law, should also be repealed.
The level of hostility, the level of intolerance with regard to LGBT people has increased very severely in the aftermath of the adoption of that gay propaganda law.
Sandra, a transgender person living in Moscow, says she was beaten in broad daylight and threatened with razors, but police were reluctant to detain her attackers.
Никаких претензий вообще к ним никаких не было.
There were no charges at all. I was told that they were fighting with people like you. You are a shame to us. Do not disgrace us.
Не позорьте народ, не позорьте вообще здесь никого.
President Vladimir Putin has defended the law, saying it does not ban homosexuality. Meanwhile, his propaganda chief once said the hearts of gays who died in accidents should be burned or buried instead of donated for transplants, calling them unfit to live. Despite the atmosphere, some gay activists refuse to stay silent.
We are openly gay.
We are not hiding in fear.
It is our defense mechanism.
For us, being open is a weapon.
Activists say LGBTs are convenient scapegoats to distract the public from Russia's real problems. Meanwhile, much of Russia's gay community remains behind closed doors. Daniel Scharf, VOA News, Moscow.
Well, with the new year comes some new music. There was a lot of great country music in 2015, but what's in store for this year? International Edition's Sarah Williams talks with Nikki Strong of VOA Music about some of the most anticipated country songs of 2016.
So, Nikki, I already know we can expect a new album from the iconic Loretta Lynn. It'll be her first one in 10 years. It's called Full Circle and hits stores around March 4th. What other country legends are releasing new music?
Well, Sarah, I just found out Willie Nelson, last year's recipient of the Library of Congress's Gershwin Prize for Popular Song, will salute the brothers George and Ira with a new album. It's called Summertime. Willie Nelson sings George Gershwin. It's due out February 26th. It won't be a traditional country album, but it should be good, as Willie puts his own touch on Gershwin standards, like It Ain't Necessarily So, and they can't take that away from me. Vince Gill is another icon whose new CD, Down to My Last Bad Habit, drops February 12th. I love that title. Vince consistently produces great quality music, and we expect no different this year. The current single, Take Me Down, featuring Little Big Town, has a sultry country rock feel. He also has a new song with newcomer Cam on it, so I'm really looking forward to checking that out. And another artist coming back from a long break like Loretta Lynn is Wynonna Judd. The self-titled CD Wynonna and the Big Noise will hit February 12th. This will be Wynonna's first full-length studio album of original material since 2003.
Wow. What other country albums by women have fans abuzz?
Well, tons, actually. A couple of them, Brandi Clark. Now, she's a brutally honest songwriter whose single Girl Next Door is a great song that basically says, hey, you want the girl next door? Go next door. You want that girl? Go get her. Bye. So she really has guts and grit, and her CD is scheduled to drop in the spring. Lucinda Williams is another bold, gritty, passionate storyteller. Her CD, Ghost of Highway 20, drops February 5th. And another woman artist I am looking forward to is Aubrey Sellers' debut CD. She's the daughter of Leanne Womack and prolific songwriter Jason Sellers. But she says she has her own sound that she describes as garage country, bluegrass, and blues songs presented in a new, edgier way.
Well, let's get into the guys. What do they have in store for us?
Okay, they have lots as well. I'm looking forward to Brothers Osborne, Pawn Shop. They're very funky and gritty, and they borrow from a lot of influences, including classic rock and modern country, and they do really good stuff. Charles Kelly of the group Lady Antebellum drops his solo project while the group is on hiatus, and I have loved what I have heard from him thus far. The single Lucky Girl was written with one of the gods in country music right now, Chris Stapleton, along with Chris Fraser, and the title track The Driver is really nice too, and it's done with Dierks Bentley and Eric Pasley, and that album is due out February the 5th. Dierks Bentley, by the way, will be dropping a new album too called Black, which he says will be deeply personal. It's already available on pre-order, but no release date as of yet. And speaking of deeply personal, Blake Shelton will drop his album, and we all expect it to be about his relationship and public divorce from Miranda Lambert. Now, he says this album is going to be very personal, and I can already hear gossip sites right now just dissecting every single lyric. So,
well, thank you, Nikki, for this country music preview. You can find a more extensive list of the most anticipated country albums set to drop in 2016 on VOA Music's Facebook page or via Twitter at @VOA_music. You can also catch Nikki every week on Country Hits USA on VOA 1.
I'm gonna take you for a date, take you for a ride, gonna get you over there on the passenger side. I'm gonna put the radio on your favorite song, I'm gonna crank it on up and get you singing along. Hey, hey.
Well, that's all the time we have for on International Edition. Today's show was brought to you by the director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Daniel Crafton. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Please send me a tweet on Twitter. You can find me at @Michael_Lippin. And the show is there, too. We are at @VOA_IE. See you next time, and have a great week.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
On the third Monday of each January, Americans honor the memory of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Dr. King, a Baptist minister from the southern state of Alabama, was a leader in the U.S. civil rights movement, advocating social change through nonviolent means. On January 15th, he would have celebrated his 86th birthday. Believing that change does not roll in on the wheels of inevitability, but comes through continuous struggle, Dr. King organized and participated in mass action boycotts, sit-ins, peaceful marches, and other nonviolent acts of civil disobedience. Dr. King once stated that an individual who breaks a law that conscience tells him is unjust and who willingly accepts the penalty of imprisonment in order to arouse the conscience of the community over its injustice is in reality expressing the highest respect for the law. And so, activists sometimes deliberately, but peacefully and respectfully, broke laws aimed at segregating the white citizenry from the non-white, thus hoping to bring attention to the inherent unfairness of such legislation. Thus, when a black seamstress named Rosa Parks broke the law in Montgomery, Alabama, by refusing to give up her seat on a bus to a white passenger and subsequently was jailed for her transgression, her plight generated national attention and increasing sympathy for her cause across the country. Dr. King was 39 years old when he died by an assassin's bullet on April 4, 1968. But his legacy lives on. In the fullness of time, segregationist laws were repealed. Discrimination is a legally punishable and punished offense. And even as we celebrate Martin Luther King Jr.'s life and enormous contribution to society, Barack Obama, the first ever African-American U.S. president, begins his seventh year in office. I never thought in my lifetime that I would see one of us aspiring to be the head of our nation, said Martin Luther King Jr.'s eldest sister, Dr. Christine King Farris. Mr. Obama leading us toward the presidency is like the promised land for us. Dr. King's life is well summed up in his own words. The quality, not the longevity of one's life, is what is important.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
Hello.